is Side Door, a podcast from the Smithsonian with support from PRX. I'm Lizzie Peabody. Once upon a time, there was a sweet little girl. This little girl was a little like Lisa Simpson. She always wore the same outfit. It was a bright red cape with a hood, and this personality quirk earned her a nickname, Little Red Riding Hood. One day, Red's grandma gets sick. Her mom cooks some soup and makes a list of favorite podcasts and sends Red into the woods to bring this care package to her grandmother's house. But once Red is in the woods, she tells a wolf where her grandmother lives. And the rest, as the Grimm brothers tell it, is a horrifying nightmare.
I was always amazed that Red Riding Hood would mistake a wolf for her grandmother. So, even dressed up, a wolf is still a wolf.
It's a story Hans Seuss grew up with in Germany. Today, he's a paleontologist at the Smithsonian's National Museum of Natural History.
These are all wonderful tales that go way back. I mean, the Brothers Grimm just compiled those tales. Some of them date back to the early Middle Ages, some possibly even earlier.
And Hans says it's not an accident that the story gets a little hairy once Red enters the forest.
Forests always were a place of mystery, so there has always been some mixture of fascination and fear about forests. So that's why, like, even in Germanic and Celtic mythology, forests have always had a very important position.
These attitudes about forests persisted for centuries, well into the era where Europeans crossed the ocean to colonize America's east coast.
They were very religious people, and of course they saw the forest as the potential domain of Satan and witches and, you know, whatever you have. Sort of a place of danger, something that you actually had to somehow conquer.
Because American colonists had to cozy right up to the edge of the forest, they felt they needed to tame it.
They thought about nature in that sort of biblical sense that nature was out there to be exploited, basically made man's domain.
And this idea of making nature man's domain prevailed in America, even after the country gained independence. Until one man held a mirror up to the young country and said, "This wilderness is part of who you are." That was Alexander von Humboldt. This time on Side Door, we tell his story. The man who used science to show us that every part of the natural world is connected, from wolves to grandmothers to lichen and squid, and who helped us, people in the United States, form a national identity around a radical new idea, that nature is not to be tamed, but to be cherished.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
Back in the late 1700s, when the forest still held a bit of black magic, a young Alexander von Humboldt was growing up. And he loved the woods. Here's the National Museum of Natural History's resident Humboldt historian, Hans Seuss, again.
Young Alexander von Humboldt would go out in the forest to look at things. So that was always sort of a magical realm, away from civilization, yet accessible in most places.
Humboldt grew up in Prussia, an 18th and 19th century kingdom that included chunks of modern-day Germany, Denmark, Poland, and Russia. His family was minor nobility. They had lots of money, fancy houses, and the best tutors. Young Alexander's favorite things to learn about were the plants and animals around him. But with that type of upper crust life came certain expectations. Prince Harry knows what I mean.
His mother had high hopes that he would become a Prussian government official, because that's what you did in those days. But clearly it wasn't the thing that sort of made him get up in the morning.
Young Alexander was a tinkerer, his mind always working. One of his first jobs was as a mining official. And even in a job he didn't love, he was driven by curiosity.
He was the first one to develop a safety lamp for the mines. He tried to think about respiratory equipment, because in those days, there were absolutely no regulations regarding mining safety. You know, you were lucky if you got out of your mine at the end of the day. And if that didn't happen, people just would shrug their shoulders. You know, it was part of the job.
When Humboldt wasn't saving the lives of miners, he indulged his real passion, studying plants and animals. He took trips to London to speak with botanists who had sailed around the world and seen plants from places he fretted he'd never see. This was the stuff that got him out of bed in the morning, and someday he hoped on a ship to see them firsthand. And these talks gave Humboldt an idea, one he wanted to test. As he studied plants at home and read reports from afar, he gained this sense that plants, animals, and climate all around the world were interconnected. When Alexander was 27, his mom died. He inherited piles of cash and, more importantly, freedom from her expectations. He would not be a bureaucrat forever. Humboldt could finally chase his dreams.
He thought, like, I'm done with all this government official stuff. I just want to see the world.
Liberated from expectations and flush with cash, Humboldt was free. But finding a place he could visit was surprisingly hard.
He wanted to go to India. That didn't work out because of all the colonial wars there. He tried to go to Egypt, but this was around the time that Napoleon was fighting in Egypt.
Eventually, Humboldt set his sights on Spain's colonies in South America.
I think a lot of people thought that he was plainly insane to even attempt to do this.
In 1799, people didn't just casually visit the Amazon. It wasn't like Humboldt could just book a ticket. He needed special permission from none other than the King of Spain.
But somehow, Humboldt could really sweet-talk people and, put it nicely, bamboozled his way into the Spanish royal house and got permission to travel those countries.
Since Humboldt's excellent adventure was a self-funded scientific journey to prove his radical notions, he needed to collect a lot of data while he was in South America. And to do that, he needed a team. He couldn't survive Venezuela's jungles alone. Here's Eleanor Harvey. I think of her as a historian, but she insists she's an art curator.
I am absolutely an art curator. I happen to be a historian because in order to be an art curator, you have to know the history, the language, the music, the religion, the politics, the political cartoons. Otherwise, the art doesn't make much sense.
Harvey is senior curator at the Smithsonian American Art Museum and has created a new exhibition on Humboldt, who, in the summer of 1799, was on a ship headed for South America. And he made sure he didn't forget anything.
He brought 42 different instruments, each one in a velvet-lined mahogany box that was carried by assistants and porters. He had sextants and thermometers. He had the ability to gauge temperature, humidity. He had multiples. He had a favorite barometer, which shows up in a number of his portraits.
After 41 days at sea, Humboldt and his many, many instruments disembark in Venezuela. And the first thing Humboldt does when his feet touch South American soil is take the temperature. A steamy 99.8 degrees Fahrenheit. And in this way, Humboldt starts exploring this continent largely unknown to European science. And it's almost as if he doesn't even know where to start.
He is measuring everything that he can, but from the atmosphere to the climate to the altitude. He is gathering plants. He is collecting samples. He is writing up everything. He's talking to all of the local indigenous people because he knows they know more about the landscape than the Spanish colonial overlords who are there.
It's worth mentioning, Humboldt is a European exploring ideas about nature that he developed with the best information he had in Europe. The indigenous people who already lived in the Americas, they had their own ways of seeing nature, which Humboldt was curious about.
He's tasting river water, trying to taste the difference between the Amazon and the Orinoco. He's actually licking the bark of trees because he hears that the local Indians can actually distinguish tree types based on the sap, and he's very disappointed that he is not able to differentiate.
There are stories about how Humboldt tested the power behind electric eels by grabbing them from the water. Nothing escaped his curiosity. And for the next few years, he traveled South America.
Sailing, walking, reading, licking, writing, drawing. Sailing, walking, reading, licking, writing. Drawing. Sailing, walking, licking.
Humboldt was particularly interested in the relationships between plants and their surrounding environment. And to prove his theory, Humboldt and his team went to some extreme lengths. Or extreme heights, I guess. Because in pursuit of data, he decided to climb what was then thought to be the world's tallest mountain, Mount Chimborazo.
Chimborazo was believed to be the highest peak on the planet at the time, close to 21,000 feet.
And Humboldt decides, in the name of science, I will conquer this mountain. It was June 22, 1802, almost 3 years to the day after he left Spain. By this time, Humboldt had climbed plenty of volcanoes, but he hadn't ever tried climbing anything like Chimborazo. And he wasn't just climbing.
Humboldt employed a number of guides who were willing to help carry his equipment up the mountain so that he could stop periodically to take measurements to collect samples.
At first, things went fine. But 15,000 feet up, the climb got sketchy.
You are talking about crevasses and glaciers and wind-driven snow. Their gums are bleeding, their feet are bleeding, Ooh. Their eyeballs are bleeding. It's not very pleasant.
Humboldt's guides quit. But through the bloody feet and gums, Humboldt continues collecting data and taking notes. Just below Chimborazo's summit, they get to an impassable crevasse, otherwise known as a huge crack.
And so they realize at 19,413 feet, they can't get to the summit. But it is a mountaineering record that stood for 30 years.
And Humboldt came out of this with more than just bragging rights.
So through all of this climb up Chimborazo, he was collecting data. What did he do with that information?
He pulled that information into the core of the Naturgemälde.
Naturgemälde, or as Hans Suess would say,
Naturgemälde, a nature painting, literally.
His picture of nature, half watercolor, half didactic information, columns of information on either side. It was an infographic that, in essence, summed up 4 years of travel in South America and Mexico, correlated against 10 years of travel and study in Europe.
Okay, we're going to take a moment to describe this nature painting that Humboldt made, because it's really important to understanding his biggest idea. Imagine a page divided into three segments, and in the center, Naturgemälde shows Mount Chimborazo.
You see the mountain itself, snow-covered at the top, and then sort of gradually grading down into greener and greener areas until it's down here in the rainforest.
On the mountain's right half, it's been sliced open, and Humboldt has filled the space with the names of plants he found at different altitudes.
It has all kinds of words and things listed on it.
This single illustration offered Humboldt's audience a brand new way to understand the planet and all life on it.
Humboldt realized that you can't see plants just in isolation if you want to understand the environment. So he actually started looking what species co-occur. How is this occurrence influenced by climate?
His goal was to show how mountain ecosystems around the world have similar plants at similar altitudes. The image also argued that altitude and latitude mirror each other.
He extrapolated that if in going from sea level at the equator up 19,000 feet close to the top of Chimborazo, that he would see the same kind of changes as if he walked from the equator to the North Pole. And if you think about it, you go from tropical zones to temperate zones, to taiga, to tundra, to permafrost, to year-round glaciers.
Naturgemälde was an illustration that showed how all plants were connected. Humboldt called his idea the unity of nature.
So basically, he was the father of plant ecology. He's the first real ecologist.
And Humboldt is one of those natural historians who understands that art and science need to work hand in hand. And what he's really doing in 1805 is throwing down the gauntlet that for the rest of his life, he will be amplifying the concept that is anchored in this picture. This is the foundation of everything else Humboldt does.
Coming up after a quick break, Humboldt visits a young country that is working to establish its own national identity. That's right, he comes to the United States and plants the seeds for the best idea America ever had, the national park system. Welcome back. So what you need to know is this. At the beginning of the 19th century, a young man named Alexander von Humboldt was traveling around South America, studying his idea that all plants and ecosystems around the world are connected. He called it the unity of nature. Now, right around this time, in 1803, America's own polymath, President Thomas Jefferson, bought the huge chunk of turf now known as the Louisiana Purchase, and it doubled the country's size. But nobody in the eastern states really knew what was out there. So Jefferson sent two military guys named Meriwether Lewis and William Clark on an expedition to go find out. Meanwhile, Jefferson was desperate to earn the young country some respect from Western Europe. But that continent's philosophers, scientists, and other thinkers kept making fun of us. They said everything in America was worse than in Europe. They even called American people and its wildlife degenerate. Eleanor Harvey told me.
Robust Europeans who come to live in the United States become smaller and weaker as a result of the bad climate here.
No.
Yes.
Huh.
Personally, I'm feeling a little insulted here. And so was Thomas Jefferson. So with all of this going on, Jefferson hears that this little-known wealthy Prussian explorer who's been running around Spanish America wants to meet him. And Jefferson says, why not?
He and Jefferson get along like they are twins separated at birth.
Like the best of friends, Humboldt and Jefferson talked about their interests and their anxieties. Jefferson complained to Humboldt that he couldn't get any respect from those Europeans. Humboldt told him, forget those guys.
So Humboldt has been all over South America refuting this right and left, going, no, the Carib Indians are basically like men of iron, and, you know, this is stronger and this is bigger, and I found mastodon teeth in the Andes, and this is all poppycock.
Poppycock. Humboldt really drives this point home that America is rich in natural beauty, old forests and dramatic nature that Europe can't compete with. He tells all of this to Jefferson.
There's a sense perched here in the United States early in the 19th century that we're surrounded by wilderness. We have a chip on both shoulders that we're not considered sophisticated enough or politically strong enough in order to hold sway on the world stage. What Humboldt does is encourages us to believe that the pilgrimages you would make to cathedrals in Europe have their moral equivalent in that therapeutic value of a walk in the woods.
They had Notre Dame. We had Niagara Falls.
We have created a national identity grounded in our landscape. It starts with Jefferson. It is given a huge boost by Humboldt, and then that is what carries us through the middle decades of the 19th century.
It's this idea that Europeans who originally came to North America to settle had been fundamentally changed by the wilderness that surrounded them. Humboldt encouraged Americans to lean into this difference.
So, instead of cultivating gardens, we go for a walk in the woods. We learn to find God in the wilderness, not the devil.
After Humboldt's time with Jefferson, he returned to Europe and became a prolific writer. He published 36 books and wrote more than 25,000 letters to scientific collaborators all around the world.
If you were even halfway educated, you would have definitely known them and likely read at least one of his works.
Humboldt was a star, especially back in the U.S.
It's like a Humboldt fan club in the United States that permeates American education and American literature and will bleed straight into American art. Yeah. Which brings us to our boy, Fred.
Yeah, Freddie.
That's Frederick Church to you.
Who is Frederick Church?
Frederick Church became the single most influential American landscape painter of the 19th century. I think I can get away with saying that.
You're the curator.
I'm the curator.
You're the
exactly.
boss.
The single most influential American landscape painter of the 19th century was himself influenced by Humboldt. Although he was born more than a half century after Humboldt, Church idolized him. He especially appreciated Humboldt's idea that art is better if it's scientifically accurate.
There's actually a really cool quote where Humboldt basically says, you know, you can marvel at the stars as they twinkle in the sky, but they move in their orbits in mathematical precision, and he's equally happy with both of those ideas. And I think it's that he conveys to Frederick Church, which is, learn your world, do the hard knowledge, bother to sweat the details, and then step back and marvel at the fact that we live in a place that has given us this much visual beauty in the service of nature.
Church and a close friend, who happened to be an independently wealthy Humboldt fanatic named Cyrus Field, they decided to recreate Humboldt's trip to South America. And I mean almost literally.
And so for 7.5 months, Church and Field are basically on a Humboldt reunion tour.
And as Church hunts for hints of Humboldt around South America, he also studies the trees, rivers, and rocks, taking his own detailed notes. He noted their shape and color so that he could paint these landscapes down to the smallest flower.
So this is a moment when Church is absorbing Humboldt's ethos. He will become known as the painter whom Humboldt so longs for, basically the American Humboldt in American art.
Even when Church returns home, he filters everything through Humboldt's eyes. And to help my eyes see Church's work, Harvey and I walked over to the Smithsonian American Art Museum. We looked at one of Church's paintings titled Cotopaxi, which is the name of a mountain in the Andes. The painting shows a snow-capped volcano. That's Cotopaxi. And a little farm sits in a clearing in this rugged wilderness.
That hacienda is actually the same one Humboldt stayed in 55 years earlier when he was near Cotopaxi.
It's a big natural landscape. And Harvey says it's easy to see Humboldt's influence in the detailed nature.
They're all of the little flowers in the foreground, the little red flowers and the yellow flowers, the trailing vines, the bromeliads, the trees. His brushwork is so exquisite. It's so small scale, and yet you can see every leaf flipping in the breeze. He's got that acuteness of vision. He picks up on all of the little details. He does not generalize, and that's what sets him apart.
Alexander von Humboldt died in 1859. By this time, his influence was everywhere, not just in visual art, but literature and poetry, all of which steeped following generations in Humboldt's ideas. If there's a knock on his legacy, it's just that he refused to focus on anything for very long. But Hans Suess says this helped Humboldt make connections across the scientific spectrum.
In some sense, Humboldt was one of the last people who kind of knew everything that there is to know about science, because this was in the period long before any kind of specialization. Obviously, the body of knowledge in those days was much, much smaller than. But because he had this broad exposure to different areas of science, he was able to sort of combine things that probably most modern scientists could no longer do. You know, we're just way too specialized, and to get sort of a whole picture, we now need basically a group of people.
When Humboldt found something cool, he'd send it to someone who was an expert. And then,
off to the next thing, you know. Oh, look at that orchid over there. Oh, that mountain.
Humboldt's curiosity was his superpower, but it was also the thing that prevented him from making discoveries on his own. His expert friends looked out for him, though, because they kept naming things after him.
The scientific name is Dosidigus gigas, which means the giant who abides by the law, but the common name is Humboldt squid.
The Humboldt penguin is named after Alexander von Humboldt.
Hacienda de Humboldt is a place in Chihuahua.
We're talking about the Humboldt River that runs across the state of Nevada.
You can imagine the Humboldt crater like a cup.
Humboldt neighborhood, Portland, Oregon.
The Humboldt current.
Humboldt County, California.
Humboldt Universität zu Berlin.
Humboldt squirrel monkey.
And many more. Ten years after he died, one of Humboldt's students made a speech in Boston where he said, "Every school child in America has been taught by Humboldt, but nobody knows his name."
So even by then, what had happened is all of Humboldt's really interesting ideas had been adopted and built on by a generation of scientists. We now know their names. Humboldt is not considered the founder of any one of the professional sciences, but he influenced the foundation layer of research in each of those areas.
It doesn't help that shortly after the turn of the 20th century, the United States and its allies fought back-to-back wars against Germany, so Americans became suspicious of anything that looked or sounded German.
German language books came off the shelves in American libraries, street names were changed, towns were renamed. Humboldt celebrations, which had been happening every 10 years since 1859, stopped. And he just faded out.
Harvey and Suze agree that although Humboldt's living memory as a person was erased in this country, his ideas haven't gone anywhere.
I think Humboldt's most enduring legacy is that he inspired a great many people to think about the conservation of nature, that people were in nature, not out of nature. And that was something that was really influential in the development of our national park system.
The national parks, land set aside for the enjoyment of future generations, have been called America's best idea. But that idea might not have taken root without the hyperactive Prussian explorer and his favorite barometer.
In 1957, Wallace Stegner, I think, put it really well when he said, essentially, we aspire to build a culture to live up to our scenery. What it culminates in, really, is the development of the National Park Service. And that is really Humboldt's legacy.
You've been listening to Side Door, a podcast from the Smithsonian with support from PRX. The exhibition that Eleanor Harvey spent the last 6.5 years curating is called Alexander von Humboldt and the United States, Art, Nature, and Culture. It will open at the Smithsonian American Art Museum in Washington, D.C. soon. Check their website to find out when. If you want to see Frederick Church's painting, Cotopaxi, the one we describe in the episode, subscribe to our newsletter at si.edu/sidedoor. We'll also share some facts about mastodon teeth that just didn't fit in this story but are weird and interesting. And definitely follow us on Twitter and Instagram at SideDoorPod. Also, if you're new to the show, or even if you aren't, leave us a review in Apple Podcasts. We love reviews, and it helps new audience members find us. Special thanks to Eleanor Harvey, Hans Suess, Laura Baptiste, Tina Tennyson, Mariah Miracle, William Gilley, Andrew Offenberger, Misha Webley, Boris Nietzsche, Diet Mawson, Patrick Kiger, Rory Wilson, Harold Heisinger, and Ashley Hall. We also want to shout out Andrea Wolf's book called The Invention of Nature, Alexander von Humboldt's New World. It was critical in the reporting of this episode. Our podcast team is Justin O'Neill, Natalie Boyd, Anne Cananan, Caitlin Schaefer, Jess Sadek, Lara Koch, and Sharon Bryant. Episode artwork is by Greg Fisk. Extra support comes from John, Jason, and Genevieve at PRX. Our show is mixed by Tarek Fuda. Our theme song and other episode music are by Breakmaster Cylinder. If you want to sponsor our show, please email sponsorship@prx.org. I'm your host, Lizzie Peabody. Thanks for listening.
For not a historian, you know a lot about history. You've got, I would say, a Humboldtian approach to your work.
I would love to be Humboldt when I grow up, but I'm 8 languages behind, and it's not going to happen.
But, you know...